It happens all the time, every day. One data point, one measure that might be interesting to your listeners, from 2011 to 2012, a bipartisan congressional commission was looking into the scope of cyber threats. And in that year alone, there were over 500,000 attacks, cyber attacks of various kinds from outside this country against businesses, commercial organizations, and the government, and 86 attacks on critical infrastructure.
And, of course, the motive for these attacks varies. But one interesting thing I read about them is that often it will be done as extortion. The threat will be made. See what we can do, and this will be worse if you don't give us money.
That's a typical tactic used by criminal organizations. They have inside information about the vulnerability of systems, especially for companies, and they will extort essentially money from some companies in exchange for not exploiting those weaknesses.
And that goes on all the time.
That goes on all the time. And because companies don't want to report it, because it obviously reflects these vulnerabilities publicly, both to their shareholders, to their corporate officers, and to their competitors, they often do it in silence. I really couldn't tell you. There really isn't good data available on how pervasive that part of it is, because the cyber threat takes other forms other than the extortion and the criminal exploitation.
What is, do you think, our biggest vulnerability? Where are we most vulnerable?
Our financial systems, without question. Our financial systems make use of the internet so they can function, so they can make transactions, they can talk to their other operating units, so they can communicate with their customers, they can communicate with their other creditors, at the retail level as well. And it was designed to make use of an internet that was designed by a group of people initially that wanted to have an open, transparent sharing of information so that all citizens could prosper and could use it to the fulfillment of their own ambitions and goals. Those wonderful people that created the internet did not take into account the security aspects and the vulnerabilities. And so what we see now is anytime there can be an exploitation of some weakness somewhere for profit, there will be someone doing it, whether it's a criminal organization, whether it's an anarchist, whether it's a state-sponsored organization that does it as a way of an asymmetric threat to protect their own interests, or if it's just someone who just has a grievance.
I would have guessed that you would have said that our power grid.
That is a subset of the vulnerabilities. I think that the power grid, because they're publicly owned, are publicly managed and overseen, and because it's been well established that they're probably the have lots and lots of vulnerabilities. I think the tide is just changing with that, because both the Congress and the State Power Regulation Commissions and the Department of Energy itself have recognized that this is a huge problem and are taking steps to address it. And I believe that in the fullness of time that we'll be able to overcome that. The financial system, in my opinion, is a different story, because they're obviously all privately held, and their weaknesses are never publicly disclosed. They don't disclose them to their shareholders, to their customers. They don't disclose them to their competitors, to the public at large. And, the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses are oftentimes hidden and covered up for all the reasons that you would expect for being a business. But until it's recognized and addressed that there are common problems among the financial industries, I think the problem is going to continue. Also, they're the most vulnerable overall, because there's more profit to be in them.
Of course, these companies and the government are working all the time to prevent these attacks. But you argue that these entities should also prepare for the inevitability.
Correct.
The consequences are where we're sort of falling short. What do we do when this happens successfully?
Oftentimes, when this situation is exercised and the vulnerabilities are uncovered, the exercises fall short of sort of long-term sustainment of the problem. And we need to look deeply into this problem for the worst case. and really discover all of the cascading and symptomatic problems associated with a long-term problem, not being accessed, having access to your fund, your finances, your funding, the ATMs, having a critical power infrastructure being offline for a considerable amount of time. And this is all designed, these exercises and these trials, so that you can build resilience into a system, knowing that there is an opportunity or a chance in the future that this is going to crash or become a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Prepare for the worst.
And in fact, the government has been very active about trying to prepare the citizenry for these kinds of disasters. And since Katrina, we've had a number of different disasters that have proven that you need to look after yourself and take resiliency, starting with the family unit, building up from there to, you know, your communities.
We've been talking about cyber attacks as if it's only something that someone would do to the U.S., but the U.S. has considered cyber attacks elsewhere.
I think the information on our capabilities for offensive cyber operation are a well-kept government secret, so I couldn't comment on that. I think it's a safe bet, though, that our military forces have the capability to strike back or to perpetuate an offensive operation should the need arise to protect national security. And this isn't a new notion. I mean, the capability to use a digital weapon, if you will, of some kind to take down, say, air defenses was considered in the first Gulf War initially. It was ultimately rejected, but we had the science and the operational ability to do it then. So it's a safe bet that we're fairly sophisticated in our abilities.
Considered, wasn't it, also in the discussion of what we were going to do with Syria?
Exactly. It was a discussion. And again, I think the public discourse on that kind of came to a close because I don't believe they wanted the terrorist organizations associated with what's going on in Syria knowing what our capabilities are. The other problem with the Syrian question was that assuming that, you know, we could act with some offensive capability to cause harm to the Syrian government, the terrorist organizations that are operating there and the other non-state actors, non-state groups, you know, would continue to press forward in their struggles. And so they wouldn't do anything to help that. And so ultimately the people that are involved in this conflict, the innocent people, would still continue to get killed and be harmed.
And, of course, a cyber war would not be something we really want to engage in.
No, absolutely. And the main reason for that is there's but a very short step between having a cyber conflict where you're really targeting systems, digital systems, computer systems, and a hot war. And the distance between the two is a short distance, not territory that we really want to discover or find out. And a good example of a history, I think, is how we've come to learn to live with nuclear weapon escalation that we had learned to address in the 60s. Riding up that escalatory ladder and retaliation potential, even if we had the weaponry and the means to deliver it, didn't mean we really wanted to consider doing it. That's mm-hmm. the same with the cyber.
And I have been speaking with David Hammond, who's director of Banyan Analytics. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.